welcome to We Cut Heads, a Spike Lee podcast. I'm your host, Spencer, and with me is... Every time I write it down, I always forget.
He's a 70-year-old man. I'm just Joel, man, okay? Yes, I'm not a character in your little play.
All right, whatever you say.
Sorry, listener. I'm feeling very angry. It has nothing to do with the movie.
No. Yeah, the movie is a delight, but it's just world circumstances right now. But we'll get to the movie in a second, but join us for the third time is Alexandria Daniels.
Hello. Thanks for having me back.
You're welcome. So we discussed before I record that we probably should bring up, talk about like the current events happening right now, because this is a little behind the scenes for a listener. This is the first recording Joel and I have done since the protests have started, and so it wouldn't make sense to one, not talk about it, and two, not talk about it on a Spike Lee podcast, especially.
Yeah.
So.
Yeah. On my what's the name of the guy who did the. Well, now I can't even remember the new movie, so forget me trying to make jokes. Hello.
Yeah. So.
I was going to say my D.W. Griffith podcast. Yeah, we haven't touched that, but, you know, that's also a bad joke. So.
Well, aside from being racist, he is apparently a bit of a creep. Allegedly, I should say.
Oh, okay.
Oh, he's long dead. Who's gonna be like, how dare you say that? Yeah, okay. he was a creep.
Yeah. He liked Charlie Chaplin. He liked them young.
Okay.
Yeah, apparently. Don't the stands of D.W. Griffith don't at me. If there are stands of them, I don't even know.
No, I'm sure they'll find you.
Yeah.
And in an age, they will.
Yeah. So, as of I think the last recording we did was 2 days before the first protest happened, the death of George Floyd, which is one of many deaths caused by police brutality in this country, and it's not a new issue. It's been happening since basically this country has formed, and it's shitty that it's taken, I don't know, almost 400 years for like mainstream news and media to actually pay attention to this.
The systematic racism is apparent right now in a much more highlighted way because of like social media and because of the coverage and because of the condition that the country was already in. I feel like, or, you know, so many people already talking about like, no, you know, because of the way Donald Trump and whatever else, and Brexit and England and like all these things that were like openly racist, but you could still say like, no, it's economic, you know, it's all this stuff like that. Like, okay, how many people have to die before you're willing to admit that there is just a vein of terribleness that going Donald through Trump. The entire world.
I think it's fair to say Donald Trump and his entire administration blew the dog whistle on this one. It was like starting with his administration, talking about law and order, and look at where we got us.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, it's the same pattern.
It's the same pattern, and it's what angers me is that there were signs of that early on before he became president, and it's like no one was paying attention, and it's sad that it took this long. It's sad that it took more violence. It's sad that it took another black. It took George Floyd and Breonna Taylor and other multiple deaths to occur in order for all of us to pay attention to the systematic racism in this country. And all I have to say is that, I mean, change probably won't happen overnight, but I know for sure that we have to actively do our part to ensure that racism diminishes in this country, that for sure.
Yeah, and that's just the tip of the iceberg. It's such a complex, ugly thing, which, like,
oh yeah,
like we've gone through almost every Spike Lee movie, and like the thing with Spike Lee, when we talk about tackles race, is it's always messy and complicated, and there's never an easy answer. And it's just the fact that it's taken this long for like a lot of people to be like, oh, actually, this is a messy, complex issue. It's like, well, yeah, it's always been a messy, complex issue. It's just like you've just been ignoring it for out of convenience. If it makes you uncomfortable.
I mean, yeah, there are people who've been saying it was messy and complex, but they also are the people that are going like, it's just the way it is. And it's like, no.
Yeah, they'll just pretend and say, oh, it's, or they'll look at the news, they'll hear another black man or black woman being shot and killed by police and say, and it didn't happen. They'll just act like, no, it's not that serious. It's very serious. Like,
must have been doing something to deserve it. When, oh, God. And take a deep breath and release it.
Take your time. It's all right. I'm angry too. There's no other way I could. I'm just telling my words right now.
I know everybody. You know.
Yeah, and there's like I said, just on the episode on Ivan Dixon, when me and Marcus were talking about like this, the movie Nothing But a Man, with, like about like that's like the life of a black man in the South in the '60s. And both of us have in common, like, we both had a parent that was from the South that, like, lived in segregation. Like, my dad, he went to the colored school for a number of years before, like, the schools were integrated. So, like, you know, we like to pretend that, oh, yeah, the Civil Rights Bill, you know, Brown versus Ford. It's not that simple. Like, I'm one generation separated from that.
Mm-hmm.
No, that fixed everything, didn't it? Just like winning World War II ended all bias against Jewish people because, right, we saved everybody. Or the way that, or let's go even further back, the abolishment of slavery, racism fixed, right?
Right.
Sorry.
Slavery still exists. Racism still exists.
Yeah.
No. I think sometimes we wish it never did, you know, but there's something about this movement at this time. It just, you can no longer pretend this is not a thing. You know, you have, everyone is confronted now with that. Yes, systemic racism is real. Now, what do we do with it? How do we combat this?
Mm-hmm.
So it just feels so much more serious than past protests and all that.
It feels special in a way because, like, at least we're seeing people mumbling about, like, police reform and things like that in, you know, we're gonna have to push them and fight them to keep this follow through to happen, mm-hmm. not just to, like, pass a few legislations and hope that everyone pretends it doesn't happen, but like everyone's recording everything and putting it out there, and it's like you can't continue to placate and pretend anymore. Like, we have to do. I'm getting fired up. Stormy weather.
I remember when the death of Philando Castile, that was the man that was shot and killed in his car for no reason. Like, that man did everything right, followed the rules and everything. He still ended up getting shot. I remember the uproar. I remember the protests even back then. But what's different between all those reactions from last time and this time, it feels like now that it's not just black people fighting for this. It feels now like everyone is kind of waking up. It's like we all have to do our part. And I can't help but feel like in the past, like whenever I would watch something on the news and I hear another story about a black man being killed and really for no reason at all, like none of my other friends will talk about it, or they'll don't really want to talk about it much. Now in the age of social media has become such a big thing, you know, we all can't help but look at, you know, the viral videos and watching the protests happen. We all kind of feel more compelled. And it's just now, like, I just speaking just for myself, like just as an African-American, it feels now it's not just black people talking about this. Now it's like, okay, there are a lot more non-black people now understanding how serious this is, and now they feel more obligated to be more active in the conversation, which that's the good thing about this protest right now, is there's more of an awareness, and now there's more of a push to create change. I don't feel like a sense of responsibility is just on me as like a the black person in the group, or just us as a black people as a whole. We're still going to do the work anyway, but now it feels like we're getting more allies, and that's at least a good thing about it.
It does make sense.
You know, it just feels like that's like I think why we hear so many people expressing the fact like don't go to your black friends and make us feel obligated to educate you. Like, don't make us feel like we have to continuously preach to you. You see what's going on in the world, take the responsibility and just go online, research, read black literature, read black history, get involved, donate, do what you can, and carry on those conversations with your other friends and your family. Like, you got a racist uncle, you know, like had those conversations, go, okay, don't say that at the dinner table, you know, like to keep that anti-racist conversation going. Like, the tone of this movement is so different compared to past ones. It feels much more serious.
It's there's been some progress already. Minneapolis, as of 3 or 4 days ago. Time flies weird during a pandemic. I'm not even sure. But the Minneapolis has defunded their police department, so they're going to start from ground up.
Well, they're planning it. The announcement was they're planning to defund the police department. So like the city council agreed that this was a non-veto decision. So I guess the mayor can't fight back or anything like that. Which it is progress, for sure. I mean, that's it's kind of encouraging L.A., hopefully, to do the same thing. That would be interesting.
I mean, yeah. Every police force, based on, like, the things that I've seen on Twitter, it's so much of the budget, of the city budget, literally sometimes more than $1 million than, like, the next highest thing. And wartime level equipment. It's ridiculous. I mean, it's crazy.
Yeah. And it makes sense to defund them anyway. It's like, use the majority of that money to fund housing for, you know, people of color or
lower income.
Homeless. Yeah, homeless, mental health programs. Use that money wisely. Why give them all to the police so they can militarize? Like, that would make no sense. It's shocking.
It's almost like the thing that the pro-gun people say, like, oh, it's a mental health issue. Like, okay, we're going to defund the police and give them mental health causes instead. Wait, that's not what we said.
Yeah, like, it should put money in public transportation so it's people need to rely on cars and stuff like that, or libraries so that, you know, there's more books and I should just, whatever. There's a million ways to make things better.
These are the things that I'm afraid of. Like, once the rich people start feeling any tugs on their pockets, like, those, like, I feel like they have the most power in this country, and I want them defeated. This is, my heart, it beats so fast thinking of the chance that, like, that change could happen. And I mean, I want to have hope in what's going on right now. Like, I want to have hope. Which is as close as I can get to hope right now, but it's, you know, it's a start.
Yeah, the only place where I'm at right now is I'm hopeful, but I just know, like, you know, it's not change. It's not going to happen overnight. So it's going to be like a long fight. So my thing is just focusing on keeping the conversation going and just holding people accountable. You know, like, people still want to be racist sometimes and still want to say anything that they feel like that they know for a fact, like, it's racist or it's implicit bias or anything like that. And that's my whole thing, is just making sure, like, we continue the conversation after all these protests. Because, like, there will be a time where these protests will die down a little bit. and people may try to pretend, you know, it never happened, or it's not that big of a deal, or that things have miraculously changed, and when it has not, and we're just getting started. So that's where I'm at. So yeah. I'm hopeful, but I'm just very focused on just keeping the conversation going.
Yeah, and there are many places to donate. I'll put a link to several places you can donate on the show notes and when this goes up. So, like, there are many ways. If you can't protest or don't want to, health reasons or mm-hmm. or otherwise, you know, you can donate. You can just talk to people. You can just on your social media spread. Can you guys hear my cat?
Yeah.
Okay.
Don't worry. It just said okay. Black just Lives keep, Matter. It's fine.
Yeah. Don't worry. Just keep going. It's okay.
Hi, Wednesday.
Okay, she stopped now. I lost my train of thought there.
You were talking about donating and
donating, using social media. Talk to people. Spread the word. Like, post articles. Talk to your, you know, just do everything you can. Go to, when the pandemic is over or lightened up even more, go to town hall meetings. You just make sure, you know, your voice is out there. Like, everyone can do better with that. I know I definitely can. And
don't be afraid to use your social media. I know, like, especially today, it seems like everyone has a brand. Forget that. Don't be afraid to be a bit political on your social media, and don't be afraid of saying the wrong thing. I think I've been reading a lot of, like, social media posts about allyship and all that stuff. And, you know, if you're white or non-black and you're afraid of speaking up or saying the wrong thing, don't be. If you feel the need to speak up to say Black Lives Matter, say it.
I mean, that's,
you know, start somewhere.
I've been taking the route of, like, not butting into things or saying anything, but I said on Twitter Black Lives Matter. I said that on Facebook because I want people to at least know where I stand. It's not my voice that needs to be seen on somebody's feed unless what I do is retweet, you know, all the articles that I think I want other people to see. I retweet when people are asking for donations to the right places like that. I'm half white, half Mexican, so but I look white, you know, so I know all the white privilege, and I just, if I can use my platform any way I can, I will. Unfortunately, I don't have any money, otherwise I'd be sending that myself, but yeah.
Yeah, that's the thing, that the coronavirus really hit people financially, so it's like, if you don't have the money to donate, it's okay. There are other ways to be active. And that could just be, reading articles, reading Black history books, and having conversations about, you know, being anti-racist and systematic racism. And just, you know, pick an avenue that you feel comfortable with and just speak your truth. And don't be afraid to speak. And just hold yourselves accountable. So that's that.
Okay, so this is the special... There's no
good segue. All right, good podcast. We're over, right? sorry.
There's no good segue out of that. But if you were to title, you know, this is a special episode on the classic musical Stormy Weather, directed by Andrew L. Stone. It's based off of, I'm not sure, you know, there's not as much information out there on it, but there is, I guess it's kind of a jukebox musical. I guess they've gone under that classification, but it's an answer to the song "Stormy Weather" by Ethel Waters, and it doesn't star her. It stars Lena Horne, who is basically a show business icon. She is a civil rights activist. She was, I believe, the first or one of the first Black women to have a contract at a major film studio. And this was one of the very, very few movies she actually got to star in. She usually was a featured player, or like would have like, or have like a like a vocal credit or something on like on a musical, but one being a movie, but or something like that. But yeah, but it's just I first heard this movie maybe when I was like probably when I was a teenager, because I had got this book on like it's called like the African American Century or something like that, and it's just these little mini biographies on people like Malcolm X and Tupac, and there's one on Lena Horne, and that's how I learned about Lena Horne and this movie. So this always kind of in the back of my mind of like one day I'll watch this.
The first time I heard of this movie was when I was writing for a beauty pop culture website, and it was just dedicated to like to Black culture and Black pop culture and entertainment. And one of the articles I was writing about was old Hollywood, and I looked up Lena Horne, and it was the first time actually kind of getting to know a little bit more about her, and that's when I heard of the film Stormy Weather, and I kind of read into it, and of course, she looks glamorous in the film, and, you know, she has a sophistication about her that is just so lovely, and it's so striking, and she just carries so, like, she's a great performer, and I was like, okay, I need to see this movie, because apparently, yeah, Stormy Weather had cultural significance, and I never came across it before, so I figured might as well check that out. I saw Cabin in the Sky first, and so this, and I saw Stormy Weather afterwards.
I still have not seen Cabin in the Sky. I've heard that's not as good as this one, but still pretty good.
Yeah, I have to agree about that.
J-Dog, had you heard of this movie before I told you we're going to talk about it?
Negative.
So this was like your first exposure to it, really, just like me saying, hey, we're going to do an episode on it.
Yeah, and when I looked at the pictures and things like that, I mean, having recently watched Bamboozled, I was like, we're going to watch this movie? Because some things go on. But,
It's definitely dated and a product of its era, but it's also important that it still exists unedited, like as it was, because like this is a Fox film and Fox was owned by Disney, and so I have a feeling that maybe Disney might edit this movie a little bit and cut out the uncomfortable parts, which was like you need to keep that in. It's historical, not like in a bullshit. We need the Confederate statues up. This is like actual. Like this is not historically important, so you can understand. Like the movie is like it's a fun light movie, but it's still you get to see like the ugly side of like yeah, but there's a lot of racism going on. It's kind of unspoken, but it's you know it's there. You can't help but you know it can't help not but be there. Mm-hmm.
I mean, to me, it felt like the kind of production that a studio head would come up with that they knew people would, their white audience would come in and be like, this is what I expected to see, and I'm actually very entertained. Like, not to say it's like, it's not, What is the word? It's not really putting down any of the like actors or like making them look like they're criminals or anything like that. That's you know that's not what the story's going for. Like these, Bill Williamson's character Bill Robinson. The character's name is Bill Williamson in the movie. Is like a soldier, right? So it's yeah. Mm-hmm. So a respectable thing there and. And, like, I couldn't help but seeing it from the point of view of somebody, like, yeah, I think Bamboozle just messed everything up for me. Thanks a lot, Spencer.
You're welcome. That movie.
Like,
I haven't seen that film yet, but I've seen, like, pictures of it. I was like, okay. Forgive me.
I mean, I highly recommend it.
Yeah, it's great. And there are definitely some references to this in Bamboozle.
Okay. Usually when I come across films with that, I kind of have to brace myself first. Like, okay, this is we're going there.
Oh yeah, bamboozled it, it holds nothing back, which is part of why I love it. But also, I know people who don't like it, which like, yeah, I can understand how someone can not like that movie very much. It's a bit abrasive, but yeah. So Stormy Weather, it's just okay. There is a light, very light plot. It's more or less just like a showcase of like, look at all these black performers of the era, which is nice. But at the same time, it's kind of like when you look into it more, you realize, oh, this and Cabin Sky were kind of the only major Hollywood ones that kind of stopped making these. Before this and during this era, like there were the race films, which was like the smaller studio, smaller budget black films. That there's a whole world of them, and you can find a lot of them on YouTube now, because the rights are kind of up in the air, and usually they're like 60 to 70 minutes, and like westerns and musicals, and they kind of vary in quality. And Stormy Weather and Cabin Sky are like the when MGM and Fox were like, oh, we're going to do one of those movies, and it's like, this is like the high-end version, but it still kind of has that, you can still tell, like, it's not, like, it looks cheap a little bit, but not in a bad way, because kind of like, yeah, the studio didn't give them that much, but they definitely were able to get out a lot, work well with, like, what they had.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think that end sequence is probably the most expensive looking one, where they actually have the rain in the background, like I guess probably projection on projection, except for they show people, so yeah. I'm not sure. Yeah, it's a camera trick thing, but you know, the dancers and costumes and stuff like that on occasion was where it stood out budget wise. You're talking about the story, it really isn't. I mean, I have a short film on my computer that's a cab. I don't know if that one's the Cab Calloway one. I have a different one that is another performer and music writer. And it's like they didn't want to just make a short film of this guy's like band and production doing a thing. So the story is he's sitting at his piano trying to think of the song, and he starts writing the notes, and then we flash into the band just playing the song anyways. It's like, you can't just put a movie up there without a story. Come on. He returned from the war.
Yeah.
Well, and he met a woman who was like almost 50 years younger than him. Yeah. Yeah. It's good.
Okay. So, do you guys like this movie?
I liked it. I have to admit, I was expecting a tad bit more, because like when I hear like, okay, it's a musical, but then once you hit play, I'm like, oh, it's more of a showcase, and I was like, this is different. But the story progresses, the more I really became to really appreciate just for what it was, and maybe it's just the world events right now, but as I was watching it, I kind of, you know, I can have some appreciation for it. Because even despite the racism that the obvious depictions of, you know, blackface and all that that's in the film, it still felt like a celebration of the talent of the 40s, you know, and that's something I can appreciate it for, you know, for what it did. And it did, the movie did open doors for African-American actors to be lead actors. You know, so it did look cheap at some points of the film, but I think just overall, it just felt like a celebration of those singers at the time, and it felt like it showcases what African Americans truly want in America, and that's the thing about the last scene that really got me. I'm not sure if the house at the end was the same house that he was looking at, that Bill was looking at in the photograph. It's when he and Selena, played by Lena Horne, they were coming together and they were looking for a home. he looks at a certain house, and then at the end of the movie, there goes the house, and they're all performing and have, like, it's basically a happy ending, basically. And it took several watches afterwards, but it just kind of clicked. It's just, no, this movie is actually showing what our people just want. We just want to see it at the table. That's really what this movie showed. And for that, I could appreciate it I could appreciate the film for that.
Yeah. And
they do like a line for line, like on the page of the way the house is outlined, and then it appears on screen. So I think that was supposed to be the house that he had the picture of. He just went and bought it himself and was sitting there talking to the neighbor's kids.
But I feel like there is the blackface minstrel performance that, if you've seen Bamboozled, you know, the part of that routine in Bamboozled, they do the routine. Joel, someone you said you liked in that movie where, like, they were saying that, like, they were cutting each other off, but they weren't specifying anything, which was apparently... you go.
Oh, it's just weird that, like, in this movie, when it happens, like, I also found it funny, you know, especially with the whole car falling apart thing. But there is a weird disconnect, because in Bamboozled, like, the audience is laughing and stuff like that. And in this movie, the audience doesn't make a sound until the curtain starts to close and then everybody claps. I'm like, wait, did they... I know why the studio did that, but it did seem weird that, like, nobody was laughing at the jokes because they were on a stage performing in this particular part of the movie. It wasn't like a conversation on the street happening between two guys. Like, they were entertaining these people in the audience. Like, were they all sitting there stone faced?
And also, like, there's the dance sequence in the early part where it's like the women have, like, these flower head dresses on, and and on the back of, like, how the center of the flower is like a black face with, like, the cartoonishly big lips and big eyes, which I totally forgot about. I was like, oh fuck, that was more gross to me than, like, the Mitchell comedy bit, because at least that was entertaining. That and the flower thing was like, oh, this is just,
that stood out.
Yeah.
Well, now the first watch, I had to pause it. And I'm like, is that what I think it is on the back of their heads? I was like, oh my god, oh my god, oh okay. I have to look this up afterwards, because it was. I was actually at a loss for words, but researched again, I came across that the headdresses were looked like the little black Sambo pictures. And if you don't know what that is, that was a children's book back in those days, and the darker characters, you know, look like African American caricatures, basically, and it's very offensive, but that's basically what the headdress were looking like. And it just speaks so much volumes about the time period that they're in. And it's weird to kind of see everyone, like, happy and dancing and, you know, really having a good time. I mean, doing the cakewalk and everything, they're all having a blast, but they're not going to forget, you know, how they're treated when you see those headdresses.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, and, like, I'm not an expert on, like, the history of blackface minstrelsy or by any stretch, but I know a little bit, and having Bill Robinson in this movie kind of makes sense to have, this is a weird, guy restart. So Bill Robinson was, like, the highest paid, like, stage performer, like, black stage performer, like, that, like toured America and stuff. And he was one of the first performers in, like, the Mitchell circuit to not do blackface, because it was expected for black performers to do blackface. Because that was just the tradition, and that's what, like, if you wanted to succeed to a white audience, that's what you had to do. And Bill Robinson was one of the first to not do that. And he stopped probably in the 30s, maybe the 20s. I'm not sure when exactly. But this movie starts in 1918 and then goes and ends in 1943, I think. It's during World War II times when it ends. If you pay attention, you get a little signal fires. But it would make sense for, like, the blackface segments to take place earlier than the 40s, given a timeline of, like, when black performers stopped, when it wasn't necessary for black performers to darken up anymore.
At least the Sambo part did, but, like...
Yeah, but that
and,
was, like...
I also thought that the African, you know, drumming thing and costume thing was, like, who's this for?
Well, I just said it's like, if you want to succeed for, like, a white audience, you kind of have to... They had to play into, you know, the horrible stereotypes, because that was just how...
Right.
That was
right.
A trade-off.
100%, yeah. He like, one of my problems with the movie is that Bill Robinson, a.k.a. Bojangles, right?
Mm-hmm.
Like, everyone, Cab Calloway, I feel like, was a hot thing during the time when this movie came out, and Lena Horne was, you know, young and coming up and stuff like that. And Bill was almost 70 at this point, I think, right?
Yeah, 65 at the time.
It feels older, you know, like I almost feel like when we see him doing his dance, except when he was dancing on the drums, he seemed to be getting lots of his movements in there. But a bunch of the other times when he was out there doing it, you know, he had this kind of stiffness to him, and like he feels like he's from a different generation. I mean, he is literally from a different generation from everybody else. And, like, I think it's the star power that must have got him in the movie, right? Yeah. People will come in and be like, oh, I recognize that name. I'm going to go see that thing like that.
Yeah, he was one of the biggest stars, like, American stars of his era.
And they even do, like, a commentary on it, because, like, during that last sequence when these two guys are, I guess, jive-talking, he's like, what the hell are they saying to each other? Like, you don't understand jive. Uh-huh. It's like, things are moving on, man.
And it does make sense. I mean, the film is based off his life a little bit, and I caught that too. As he was dancing, and it's like, oh, this is he's really reflecting now on his career, basically, and it just kind of it made sense that wasn't as quick as it was before, but I still thought he brought enough energy into the film, and that was like enough for me to kind of like carry on through, like, just I think
he's one of the few like actors, like everybody else was performers, but he'd been in a bunch of movies, so yeah. I think that helped push along the story angle.
Was he already in he already starred with Shirley Temple, right, when he did was that before or after?
Was his last movie, his I last thought movie. I read
yeah I went before
I do, a little before. Okay, so yeah, he was already well known for his tap dancing and everything.
Yeah, he I believe he died with like little money and kind of like his last few years are very depressing when you learn about them.
And you could find that story repeated, I'm sure, for almost any person in this performance.
Yeah.
Let's go back to Black Lives Matter.
Ha McDaniel had
don't get angry again.
But one of the side characters, Cousin Jake, Nick Stewart, he is the voice of Br'er Bear in Song of the South.
Mm.
I've seen that 100 times. No, I'm just kidding. I wouldn't have recognized it.
I saw that movie in school because my teacher decided to show us it because political correctness is stupid or something. He went on weird rant about that. Yeah,
he really showed you.
I won't go into more detail so that people can figure out what I'm talking about. But
you know, were you going to say something else about the his was it his cousin? Is that what it?
Cousin Jake. Yeah.
Yeah.
But the cinematographer Leon Shamroy, he went on to do Cleopatra, the 5-hour one from the '60s, Planet of the Apes, Desk Set, the Spencer Tracy Hepburn and Katharine Hepburn movie. And he did Roxy Hart, the second adaptation of Chicago, the one with Ginger Rogers.
Mm.
Oh, cool.
They're singing in that one?
no, the musical didn't exist yet. It was still a normal play.
Oh, you know, sometimes people just throw songs into movies that weren't musicals anyway, so you never know.
Okay, fine.
Can I pause for a second? I have to go to the bathroom. I'm sorry.
Were there any dance numbers or like songs that really stuck out to you?
Yeah. Let me see. It's from Fats Waller and his duet with Atta Wall, Ain't Misbehavin' and That Ain't Right. I loved those musical numbers. That was just so much energy. And I don't really listen to jazz much, but I liked hearing the what's the technique called? It's like the slide piano, the stride piano, like hearing the swing music. And Fats Waller has so much energy in his performance. I just loved watching him. Like, his eyes are rolling, he's smiling, there's so much joy. And you know, and that's something to say about, that says something a lot about our culture and you know, just the hardships that we deal with. We still find a way to smile. We still find a way to have joy. And that's the one thing I like about this movie. Like, despite the racism that was surrounding them in the worst way, you know, they were still able to perform and entertain for others, you know, and they did it with a smile on their face. Like, it's like they kind of like just transform their pain into music.
Like, all the performances, like, like the first time I watched it, my favorite performance by far was the Nicholas Brothers at the end, because that dance number is, I don't understand how anyone can like memorize like 10 minutes of that, including like all the splits. Like, that's just fucking crazy.
They are incredibly talented. Like, they're acrobats and they're tap dancers. They were the combine the two. Yeah. It looked painful while they're going down the stairs. It looked really painful.
Yeah, it did.
Yeah. So
I saw that scene before I saw the movie, and I'm still shocked. And I'm like, this is crazy.
If you watch those guys' faces too, they're kind of feeling it at the end. They're like,
yeah.
But they know like their boss. Like, they're like, oh, no one can top this. Like, you know that. They show that. It's like, come on, like, okay, this hurts, but no one can top us. It's like, go ahead. I like that.
Yeah, Joel, have you ever seen that before? Because that's like a common thing. Like, people post like, "See, it's crazy dance number from this old movie." Like, I've seen it go around on like, Facebook and stuff like that.
No, I actually hadn't seen it.
Oh, because like I didn't spoil. Well, I can't even spoil it because it still looks amazing every time you see it.
The dance sequence thing.
Yeah, and the Nicholas Brothers went on to work with like Michael Jackson and other, like, I think
Janet and Mike.
Yeah, and a bunch of other famous people. So like, they're, even though their movie career was very brief, because this was like the biggest movie they ever did outside, and then they did some other stuff when they were younger, because they were pretty young at this point, like when they were little kids. Like, there's, I've seen some movies from the 30s where like they got to show off, but like, for the most part, like, their movie career kind of died after this, and they just became like stage performers and like would teach like pop stars and actors dance routines. Did the opening at the ball, did that remind either you of Malcolm X, the opening of that movie?
A little bit, it did, because it was like, what, after World War One, I believe, and they're invited to a party. Yeah, that might be a little bit of that.
There's that unfortunate fat joke, but like in Malcolm X, like the it's turned around where like the fat girl actually gets to be part of the dance routine, and this one they don't. But like I feel like Spike was definitely referencing Malcolm X. I mean, Spike was the reverse. Spike was using this as an influence on that whole sequence in Malcolm X. And remember Mo Better Blues a little bit? Was this like the following like the career of performer, and you know, and they stop performing at a certain point. It's just like a much more stripped down version of it, but like there are definitely parallels to Mo Better Blues.
Did you have a favorite number?
For me, it would have to be either the when he's on a steamship, and there's that band from I think it's like Louisiana or something, and they're just like having a jam session, and like there's one guy like wearing a top hat looking like Flava Flav a little bit. It was maybe like 2 minutes at the most, but
you poured out that sand though. You need that for fires.
Oh, well, who cares? He's tap dancing.
He's tap dancing. He needs it.
Yeah, I know.
And a tie between that or just like this time around, I fucking love the stormy weather sequence. Because you get Lena gets her solo, and then the camera zooms into like the background where it's like, how is this a stage show? Who cares? It's a movie. It looks cool, and you get like the amazing seat like ballet seat, like I guess ballet. I don't really know dance at all, but
yeah, it's a ballet.
Okay, yeah. And that was Catherine Dunham and her dance crew. Group, I don't know if the word.
And then, yeah, it was a Catherine Dunham dance company or something like that.
Yeah.
But that was her entire dance troupe.
But that whole sequence is just kind of incredible. Because, like, up until then, you don't get anything that complex, like, visually. And it's like, it's just, like, so elegant and, like, it's, I don't know, like there's a, there's like nice variety in that sequence too, because it never gets boring. It keeps shifting and changing, and it's always interesting. Joel, did you have a favorite number or song?
I like the whole Fats Waller performance when he's whoever the woman at the bar is that just starts singing with him while he's playing. And they're doing like a back and forth where she sings a line, he's like, you know, says something about it afterwards.
That ain't right.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
I think that one is my favorite out of the bunch. Like, when it comes to, like, productions, that like, you really can't beat that dance number at the end, but, like, musical performances, yeah, that was my personal favorite.
And, like, Cap Calloway's great, but, you know, he gets outshined a little bit. But outside of that, like, I just like his music in general. But,
I like his voice though, Cab Calloway. He has good, like, he's known for like his scat ability and just how he has a song with I think it's called Minnie the Moocher, and he has the Heidi Heidi Ho call and response. So like he does get a bit outshined in this movie, but I think like just vocal talent wise, I think that was really impressive.
Yeah.
You know.
But, like, I saw a Letterboxd review saying, like, this movie is, like, full of triple threats. Because you get, like, Bill Robinson, Lena Horne, and Cab Calloway. Like, and it lasts, like, 20 minutes. It's, like, it's just all three of them just, like showing off, like, look, like, we are some of the best performers in America. Let's check us out. And it's just, like, oh, this, it's, like, and it never feels exhausting, which... I don't understand how they pull that off exactly, because there's so much just like songs and dance numbers. Like you would think it would get boring at a certain point. Like if you, because like it's the story is minimal. There's maybe what 20 minutes of story at the most, and it's like it just like I don't. It's just edited so perfectly so that it never quite gets boring or like repetitive.
I mean, yeah, you're right though. I mean, the plot is very thin. And I think that's kind of like the only The only thing I really didn't like about it, I wish there was a bit more to the plot. I mean, it's only, I think, 70 minutes long at least. So it's a rather short film, and it just kind of goes straight to the point. But with that minor plot and everything, it just actually allows the actors and singers to shine even more. So you kind of like just don't mind that it's a slim little plot, you know, just about a dancer and a song just getting together. You just kind of, yeah, it's, it doesn't really go where. It's just a simple story, but it highlights everyone's talent. You know?
Yeah.
It's kind of like, don't mind the story, just highlight their singing ability, and that's okay.
Yeah, it feels like everyone else was like their friends, because I feel like it started probably Bill and Lena, and they're like, and they're probably friends with Cap Calloway and friends with Catherine Dunham, and probably. And, like, you know, this probably, it just feels like everyone was hanging out, having a good time, which really does.
Yeah. It's a good movie. It's a good movie for those that don't like musicals, like the traditional musicals, you know, like the regular MGM, like Sound of Music and Chicago and all that stuff. You may not like all those other musicals, but this is a musical that I think non-musical fans will enjoy. Just look at it as a showcase of singers and dancers.
Yeah. And, Joel, you've been a little quiet.
Huh?
You've been a little quiet back there.
Yeah, I'm petting my cat. Leave me alone.
Okay. of the musicals we've covered, do you like this one the most?
Oh, no. No.
No?
No? Yeah, I mean, what else? We got Chicago. We got this one.
Dancer in the Dark.
Dancer in the Dark.
Dancer in the Dark. Oh, Jesus. You stabbed me in the eyeball. I guess if I had to choose between those three, dear God, Chicago, I guess I would pick, even though I don't particularly like it. And it's not because this, like, when I think of a musical, this isn't the type of movie I think of. Like, this is, like I said, barely a story and then a bunch of performances. It's not. They don't sing songs that are, like, pertaining to the plot or spontaneous, like, they'll be talking and then you break into a song kind of thing. That's the kind of thing I think of when I think of musicals. And I know that this is also a musical. I'm not saying it isn't a musical. It's just, I guess that's my preference. I don't know. It has nothing to do with the quality of the movie compared to the other two, because you've put me in a terrible position.
Okay.
I like The Sound of Music. Okay. Like I'm not a full on musical hater.
No, like this film, it feels like a different kind of musical, you know, it's like its own little style. So like when I think of musical, I think of grand overtures, high budget, you know, something like Chicago, you know, but this is just, it's just everything's scaled back, you know, it does not have a big budget, of course it doesn't, you know, back in those days, but, you know, so I can't expect much, but I definitely wasn't expecting, you know, like I said before, a minimal plot and just, if it's like a genuine, almost like a talent show, but a grand, jazzy, upbeat, musical, which is something I think I know for a fact I felt like I needed to see this. This is like the right time to watch something like this.
Mm-hmm.
But like going off like the runtime and like the slightness of it, like this is like the what typical race movie of the era would be. I guess kind of make a just enough of a plot and then, you know, it'd be like a western, so you'd get have like a lot of like the western gunfights and maybe a scene with a horse or two. Or, like, be a musical, but it'd be, like, a very low-scale musical. And usually they're, like, at the most 80 to 85 minutes. Like, that would be long for one of these types of movies. So this just fits into that whole, like, subgenre. Let's see, another, I'm sure one of you two noticed that Gabe was in Casablanca. He's a piano player.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that, like, besides Lena and Bill, I think he's probably the biggest name in this movie. But, yeah, there's, I mean, it's a slight movie. There's, you know, we kind of talked about it, cover everything. You know, it's, it, like, if you're on the fence about it, just know, like, yeah, it, like, some parts, like, didn't age well, but it's, but, you know, it's a product of its era, and it's also important just to see, like, this is just what the Black experience was like. Like, it doesn't, it's not, like, gritty or dark or anything, but, like, you do get the little hints of, like, this is just what life was like. And it's just, like, and if you're one of those people who complains about runtime, it's, like, 75 minutes or something like that. So, like, you know, there's no excuse, really. You know, take out some time and get popcorn, ice cream, whatever, and just, like, have fun watching the Nicholas Brothers, like, doing jump splits over each other for 5 minutes.
Yeah. And just hearing good jazz swing music. You know, that's the... Like, this film's a treat, honestly. It's don't worry about it, about the film having a very thin plot. It's almost as like, don't worry, like, just like, that's not the point, sort of. It's like, I kind of want to say that. It's, I mean, just focus on these singers and, yeah, take note of the time period that they're in and just understand, like, that's just what life was like back then. And as I said before, you know, even while they were living in those times, they still relied on their talent and they still managed to create a lot of joy for themselves and for others. And I think that's a big takeaway, you know, about our culture, about Black culture, and how that still is a thing now, you know, like, even today, I'm diving a little bit to Black Lives Matter, just a little bit. But you see, you know, whether it's online or, you know, just your day to day, you know, we tend to make light of things sometimes, even in the midst of struggle. And I think this film kind of shows that. It's worth your time. I'll say that. It's like almost like a history lesson, but it's a good music experience.
Yeah, and there's amazing costumes in it. Like, Lena Horne looks fucking amazing.
Yeah, she looks elegant and just so captivating. I love her stage presence.
Yeah, I remember when she died 10 years ago, my reaction was like, mm-hmm. I thought she died, like, in the 80s. Like, because, like...
No.
Because she's 92, so, like, she lived a good long life and got to live to see, you know, like, things get better. Like, cause going from, like, when she was born and was a child, like, it is nice that, like, you know, at least some people from that era got to, you know, see some progress get. And, Joel, you recommend this?
I think it's an important piece of history. I think that you should watch it just to see these performers doing what they get to do, whether or not it's a good movie. Like, I don't think I would watch it again, you know, as like a, trying to study the film or something like that, but I feel like it would be important to show it to certain people and point out, like, either for the purpose of pointing out, like, these are some of the famous people that probably get way less, or that, not probably, that get way less love, but they did amazing work back then, you know, and then to also show, like, the expectations of what kind of performances could go on screen just to get this movie made. You know, we couldn't avoid having any Sambo references or, you know, even blackface, which, yeah.
That's classic Hollywood for you. We like to pretend it didn't happen, but there's a whole lot of it. Yeah, so this is 1943. Other movies came out that year. And I really don't have any, so I'll let you guys go first.
So the other film I want to recommend is Cabin in the Sky. That came out around the same year, and it was directed by Vincent Minnelli. And it stars Lena Horne and Ethel Waters and Eddie Anderson. It's another musical, and it's not so lively as it's not Yeah, so I'll leave it at that. It's not so lively as Stormy Weather is, but it is a well-made, well-put-together musical, and it's a story, a morality story, about a man who has, like, a gambling addiction, and he tries to clean up his act, but he gets killed, and his guardian angel actually kind of brings him back to life and says, you're going to have a second chance. So basically, it's just a film of him trying to get his life together, make his marriage work, and, you know, clean up his reputation. Has good musical numbers. A great cast. Again, Lena Horne shines in this movie. I love her. She's fantastic in this. And I highly recommend it. It's another important film for, like, Black films in general. It's another film that opened doors for Black actors to be seen in starring roles. So it's very important.
And and Cabin in the Sky is shows, like, the other side of the race films, which they're either, like, musical westerns or, like, urban movies, or they were, like, religious, like, morality plays.
Yeah.
But J-Dog, what do you recommend?
Well, to go along with the themes of, you know, social awareness and race and stuff like that, I'm going to recommend this Universal movie that only stars white people. All right. And it actually is slightly racist, having to do with a ancient Mayan formula that's discovered that can make a person into a zombie, a ghoul. Before zombie meant they were, you know, living dead. It was kind of like a...
it was like a reinterpretation of slavery.
Right. Well, Cabinet of Dr. Caligari, like, sleepwalking type thing, so you can order them around.
Yeah.
Anyways, this movie's called The Mad Ghoul. And we did an episode of it on my science fiction and fantasy movie podcast, Please Don't Send Me Into Outer Space. And it was a randomly selected movie, so it was surprising. It's about a scientist who gets a man to become a zombie because he thinks a woman should be with him who is in love with somebody else. And so he has this ghoul dig up the recently dead so they can carve out their hearts, or he kills them and to carve out their hearts so that he can continue his experiments and eventually control the love of his life, you know, through his Mayan mystical potion. Anyways, it's pretty entertaining. And it's not one of the Universal movies a lot of people talk about. It was recently released on Blu-ray by Shout Factory, I want to say, in like a Universal movies set. But hopefully that makes it more available to people. I think I just rented it, though, so it is available in general. Mad Ghoul.
All right. And
Spencer, why are you so afraid of the past? That's my question. movies came out in 1943.
The 40s is, for me, a huge blind spot. For some reason, like, 30s and 40s, I have skipped over a lot. Except, unless it's like Ozu or Kurosawa. But on that note, their Kurosawa's debut film, Sanshiro Sugata, Part 1, came out this year, and it was based off a novel that was, I think, based off of a real person, loosely or not so loosely, I can't remember. And it's just the Kurosawa themes of, like, teacher and student. It's been so long, I kind of forgot the major Kurosawa things, but, like, it's kind of like you see this movie and you, like, think of Seven Samurai and then like, and Ran and stuff like that, you can go, like, okay, like, it like, from the beginning, like, the things he was obsessed with and showing on screen, like, are there from the start. Even has, like, the Kurosawa motif of a flower playing a key. So, like, a key part as, like, a important symbol of, like, growth or enlightenment or something like that. And there's some great judo fights. And if you want to see some good, just like people getting thrown around on the judo mat, watch this movie. And if it's he got better. Like it also, it's a propaganda movie, so like there definitely is a whole lot of like coding of like you know, support the emperor. He's the best type of bullshit. But but you can ignore it. Like it's still still like good movie.
It's kind of what you had to do in Japan before the end of the war. Is they had to be partially patriotic in some way.
Yeah.
Another reason to watch it. You can see the person who resembles my father the most, Takashi Shimura, get thrown around in a couple of judo matches.
Yeah, he's supposed to be like a badass judo guy, but he gets defeated pretty quickly, if I remember correctly.
He is like the head of the dojo in that case, and when he thinks that he could easily beat Sanjiro. And it, you know, unfortunately ends up embarrassing himself, but not like he's not like the antagonist.
No. The antagonist, like, he dresses very Western and very, like, European. Part of the whole propaganda angle of it. And the sequel is pretty good. I think it's, I don't know, the propaganda is even heavier in a sequel, but it has a great fight in the snow of, like, karate versus judo, and it's kind of, like, it really is worth watching, like, both these movies, just for, like, the ending fight scenes.
The second movie has him literally fighting an American boxer or an English boxer.
Yeah.
Like, oh yes, Japanese martial arts is much better. And you know, I'm not disagreeing.
Yeah. But those should be on the Criterion channel, I'd imagine. So this is coming out in a couple days from the recording. So, later this week, on the Friday of this week, a recording is when Spike's new movie comes out, The Five Bloods, and we will do an episode on that with, I'm going to try to get Jared Gilman for that one, because he's only seen a couple Spike movies, so he'll be on for the newest Spike movie, and he'll be on for Spike's first movie. This has, like, a fun little experiment to, like, throw him in the deep end of, like, the most recent and where it all started. So, that will be later this month. Alexandria, do you have any stuff coming up or coming out?
I got some things that I'm working on. Can't really speak too much about it, but I got a couple stuff I'm working on for my blog, because I haven't written there in a while. So.
And J-Dog, updates for you?
I'm too depressed to talk about my work otherwise. That thing that we've probably talked about and other things, I'm still working on it, even though I think I originally said it was going to be earlier in May, but it's coming along.
Okay, we can ask the guest about that when we're done with this, actually.
Mm-hmm.
And I recently updated Jailhouse 701, Japanese Cult Cinema, with a quick update of what's going on with my life, because I haven't written on it, and I won't be back on there for a little bit for just variety of reasons, and you can read that, and that kind of has listed, like, the next 8 to 10 reviews I have planned out. Go check that out if you're wondering, like, why I've slowed down on that. And, that's it. See you guys next time for, the music one, the Denzel Spike movie, the jazz one he did.
Mo Better Blues.
Yeah, Mo Better Blues with Scott Burrow. That was a fun time. And, that's a really good episode. So, see you guys for that. Alright, thank you, Alexandria.
Thank you for having me.
The show's email is highandlowpod@gmail.com. It made no sense to change email, so it's the same feed. The show can be found at podbean.com, and Spotify, and other places you can find podcasts. Please rate and review whenever possible. The logo is by Josh Hollis. The music is by James Fell, and thank you for listening.